Welcome to What Happened Next, a podcast about newish books. My name is Nathan Whitlock, and I'm a writer. On this podcast, I speak to other writers about what happens when their new book is no longer new, and it's time to write another one. I've already had a lot of great conversations about the weirdness and pleasure of being a writer, so please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you do enjoy these episodes, which go up every Monday morning without fail, please tell other people about them. I do this on my own, so it helps a lot. If you want to send me a suggestion for a future guest, or comment on an episode, or just find out more about what I am doing, I have books of my own, hint, hint, please go to nathanwhitlock.ca. My guest on this episode is Denise DaCosta. Denise is an author and visual artist who studied creative writing at the University of British Columbia and is an alumna of the Humber School of Writers and the Diaspora Dialogues Mentorship Program. Denise's debut novel, And the Walls Came Down, was published in 2023 by Dundurn Press. Author Zalika Reed-Benta called And the Walls Came Down, quote, a beautiful exploration of memory and perception that will linger in the minds of readers long after they've finished. Denise and I talk about how she learned to handle the public side of being a writer by reciting poetry in church as a child, how her colleagues in the corporate sales world reacted to the launch of her first novel, and how she is looking forward to having written and published enough books that she starts to forget what's in each of them. We have done a few author events together, and the one thing I realized right away was you're extremely well-spoken, and I immediately felt intimidated to the sense of, like, I don't have considered answers like this. Like, I'm just flying off the top of my head. First of all, I don't mean to put pressure on you for this conversation, but... But I do wonder, where does that come from, do you think? Has that always been just an ability you've had, or is it something you've developed? Because honestly, most authors that I know anyway, they see public speaking as a kind of necessary evil, and they can clam up in front of an audience and they can give the, like, forward, blunt answers. But you were just delivering these things as if you'd been given an hour to think about them.
Well, thank you for that. Certainly, it's not how I see myself. I think if I come across as assertive and confident in my material, it's for two reasons. Number one, my day job. So I'm a people leader. And so having to lead and guide individuals in a corporate setting requires a certain assertiveness in a way. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a part of it. But I also grew up reciting poetry. So when I was really, really young, and I think even though that practice didn't carry out throughout my later years, and I would not consider myself a very extroverted individual, but I think maybe I'm pulling a little bit from that at times. I still get nervous before I speak. If I know I'm going to be in a public place, but the material matters. I think that most authors, as much as we like to joke and say they don't really like talking to people unless they have to, when they're talking about their source material, they don't hesitate. They don't stutter. They know that content inside and out. I think that's where that comes from.
I think that's probably true, although... The contrast would be someone like, I interviewed Jill Adamson on this podcast, and what Jill said was, if you were to ask her about a writer she loves or a book she loves, she can go on for an hour, just, again, extemporaneously. Ask her to delve into her own work and come up with some of the sources and where did this idea come from, and she suddenly feels like, her tongue, you know, gets big and you can't, she feels so much more comfortable doing the opposite of kind of getting outside of herself a little bit. I need to ask you about the poetry thing. Sure. You said you grew up reciting poetry as if that was just A thing we all do. Where did that come from?
Church.
Okay.
Yeah, my grandmother used to encourage me forcefully to recite poetry in church because I had a good memory. So
Wow.
I would take these long poems and recite them. And I remember when I said, I'm not doing this anymore. I think I was like 12. Enough. But
Were
yeah,
do people really into that? That they love to, like, did you get a good reception or?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the environment is very supportive of performances. Church is where you learn how to perform, you learn how to sing, you're in front of a crowd reading Bible scriptures. So that's actually a really great place to learn those skills.
And you mentioned your sort of day job, your alternate reality, which is
Yes.
in this sort of sales and corporate world. Has it helped there as well? This feeling of like, I can stand in front of a big group of people. I can face a crowd. I can deliver whatever needs to be delivered.
Oddly enough, that setting creates a different environment.
Hmm.
So I think the nature of corporate and my place in it, being, you know, being on the was it the margins of the artistic world, as it were, I'm always feeling like a fish out of water. So that's a good question around whether I pull that from there, because I don't feel like I've always been that confident in corporate, but maybe it's just a feeling that I'm projecting. I think I feel better as I've had gained more experience. I've gotten older, but it didn't come naturally, I wouldn't say.
And in terms of this, in terms of your first novel, in terms of And the Walls Came Down, I know that from hearing you speak about it, you were working on it for a long time. It was sort of a long process of many drafts and many revisions and many rethinkings. Was while that was happening, you were also building your career in the corporate world, and you were doing work in the art world as well, and having these other pursuits and other lives. Where did you fit all of this in your brain? Like, was the work you were doing in the corporate world like, this is just my job? Meanwhile, there's this book out here that has to get done. Or did the book sort of vanish in your head for certain periods?
The latter. In a way, the practical application of actually sitting and writing and that behavior, I did not have a regular schedule, which is probably why it took so long. I would write in bursts. So I think I would look for downtime in my corporate life when my mind wasn't preoccupied. And quite frankly, the work that I would have been doing earlier in my career would not have been as consuming as, say, the work that I do now. And so, yes, work is just a job. You go in and you kind of leave it there. And then whatever space you have outside of family and school and everything else, you fit this little book in. And sometimes I really sit and wonder, Nathan, where did I find the time to write this? But it's a testament, I think, to maybe when you're really passionate about something, you find that time and it doesn't feel like you've been burning out doing it because it's just something that you love.
And there's generally, this is very massive generalization, but there are roughly two ways that your day job can interact with your writing, your creative work. And one is if you're in an environment where you're constantly, like if you're teaching in an MFA or something,
right,
where you're always surrounded by writers and publishing people, it's your reality. So switching over to like, now I'm going to go work on my manuscript just feels like moving into another room. Like I'm just going to step into this second room. But your job is quite a bit removed in terms of your goals, in terms of your agenda, your day to day. And yet I almost wonder, did that help at all in terms of like making it clear that this is your passion and you, this is a focus that you want to do and work on the book? Or did you have trouble kind of leaving that behind to get into the mode of, no, this is a literary thing that I have to clear my mind for?
You know, the brain is an interesting mechanism. It does not switch back and forth between things very easily.
No.
And so I will tell you that I struggled to make that transition within a day, within a single day. It's almost like you need to decompress and then jump back in and then also be feeling well enough to write, you know, being creative enough, having the environment. Like, it feels like there is a perfect time and place to do it when you're done work, when the kids are in bed, when et cetera, et cetera. And at times it was really, it was a struggle to commit. Absolutely. I would never make it seem as if it's this, you can just switch from, you know, shut your email down and open up your manuscript and there you go and you've got all the answers. Sometimes there's just nothing, like you're burnt out from all of the talking and the energy that you've expelled during the day on other things. So yeah, there were times where I am pretty sure that if I was in an arts environment, that it would have been a different experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Beyond just your own sort of, you know, what was happening, and you, again, having to transition in your own brain, was there a sense also socially or culturally, like, it's not like you can go to one of your work colleagues and go, yeah, I was really struggling with my last chapter last night.
Right.
Or, I'm on my third, fourth draft and I don't know where that character is coming from. And I got to work through the dialogue. It's not like these people are anti-art or anti-writing, but they just wouldn't be able to provide the, like, oh, what you need is to put away that draft and work from another angle. Did it ever sort of feel even a little lonely at times of like, I'm just working on this thing that I can't talk to other people about?
Very. And that's why getting involved with the Humber School of Writers was integral to getting published, attending the Fold Festival, applying for the Diaspora Dialogues Mentorship Program. Those were the organizations that really helped me feel like there was a community. And so you're right. There are two things that happen when you're not necessarily surrounded by professionals in your craft or people who've had previous experience and none of your friends are in that field. You're completely isolated, which means you're probably going to make a lot of mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't have anyone to guide you or to you know, to kind of troubleshoot with. You don't have any mentors. So I noticed the difference right away once I started aligning with those organizations. And I would encourage anyone who was in a similar position to make that a priority.
And just as a full disclosure, even though I work, my day job is at Humber College.
Yes.
And kind of parallel to their writing program, I'm not making this an ad for the creative writing program. You brought that up yourself. I didn't lead you there. This was not a sneaky way to promote my day job. I wonder too, though, now that the book's been out for a while and you have a different perspective on that whole process, that long process of writing the book and then having it come out, bringing it out into the world. Because I don't want it to be just leave it as just negative, like, oh, your terrible day job and your wonderful writing career. Is there any feeling of like you were actually able to do certain things because your day job was disconnected from this book you were creating, where even making those mistakes, sometimes that can be good for a writer to make certain mistakes in isolation and have to work through those on their own and find their own way, rather than just have someone else tell them the way to get around them?
Yeah, so I realized upon reflection that as a creative, your creative spirit, that piece of us that is just authentically geared to make something, whatever it might be, has a trajectory. Like it has its own trajectory. You can create something truly, truly authentic based on your ignorance and your kind of the minor learning that you pick up from reading as a child, or you know what you may have ingested on television, or like you pick up these small pieces of information and you manipulate them to create something without having someone tell you that that's the way it's supposed to be. And what I love about that is the contrast, and what you get from the actual process that's in place is a conflict that you must then get over. But the conflict, it raises a question, what is good writing, right? And so what about your writing makes it worthy? What about it do you want to retain? So it starts to raise those questions for you as a creative individual. And you're then able to separate, at least I was, what I truly love about my work and what I think is important and what I need to adapt to make it make sense.
Right. In other words, instead of just taking it for granted that all writing is great because everyone I am surrounded by is a writer, and we all keep telling ourselves that all writing is great, you have to come to that somewhat on your own to like really find the meaning and find the value in that a little bit. Not again, you were doing mentorships and you were doing working through with diaspora dialogues. So you weren't totally in isolation, but you did have that feeling of like, I need to figure this out. So you got to inject the value into it.
Correct. Because when I brought it to them, because I'd already written it and brought it to my first teaching, teaching setting. So I'm here, I'm in an academic setting for the first time, presenting my work for the first time, not having had any creative writing experience, which I've come across quite a few authors who've had that experience as well. And they're going to tell you, this is a good story, but here's what you need to know about structure and voice and, you know, tense. And you see the things that you struggle with, and you start to see the words that you repeat and the good and bad habits that you lean on in storytelling. And then it doesn't become, it's not a judgment. It really is a craft like everything else.
Yeah.
So then I hope I'm answering your question, but the job itself allowed that other side of me to be responsible and and also it made me feel okay to write. I felt okay to write because I'm also contributing to my household and taking care of my family and doing the things that are important to me. And I love to work. So if I was just sitting there writing and I wasn't making an income, or I wasn't able to participate fully in that in that industry in other ways either, because I don't have those transferable skills, right? I think that would have been difficult for me.
What has been the reaction to some of your colleagues in the corporate world? Have they read the book, or are you still concealing that reality from them?
I was unable to do that, and I don't remember what happened. I think I may have mentioned it to one of my old leaders shortly after the book was published, and he made an announcement, you know, like, hear ye, hear ye.
Oh, right. Everyone, gather around.
Exactly. So I work for a wonderful, wonderful corporation, and they threw me a launch in the fall.
Nice.
And bought a number of the books to gift to the employees in the company. And so, yes, many of those employees have gone on to read the book, pass on the book, Sometimes they just put it on their bookshelf, so it's there when I turn on Zoom. They've got it up.
Nice.
Super supportive. That has been a very wonderful experience. That is the only opportunity, I think, that I've had to merge those two worlds. Otherwise, they're completely separate.
Well, then I have a question. What would I need to do to become like an intern? I could be an unpaid intern at that company. I could be like a mascot. I'll dress in a costume for the picnics just to kind of get that same launch and buying a bunch of copies. Is there an opening for me somewhere there?
Listen, you would do great there. You would fit right in. You would not have a problem. I think that, when you have an organization that is privately held, help, because they still have their own culture that they can, that they don't necessarily need, every board member to sign off on to do something. And
right.
They really are people focused. I think they believe, which is true, that your employees should have a complete life, and it should not just be work, and that you bring your entire self to work. And if you are doing something outside of work that interacts with the community, that can be a part of your work culture as well.
We mentioned Humber College, and I remember right at the start of the pandemic, when we all got sent home and we were all flipping our classes to online, the faculty that I work in, which again contains the Humber School for Writers, they came up with this idea to, like, as a kind of little gift, they sent out a copy of a book by one of my fellow faculty members, because I have a lot of writers on the faculty. They sent a copy of that writer's newest book, and we all got it in the mail, and we got a little package in the mail. Like, look, we got so-and-so's book. And of course, there's a lot of writers on the faculty, and since then, many of them have put out books. And I've always thought, like, hey, when are we going to do that again? When are you going to buy up like 100 copies of this?
It's a fair question. I'd want to get on the list, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, you do it for one, you have to do it for everybody. Something interesting that you do, I saw something advertised where you were doing a walking tour related to the book, because your novel is set in the Regent Park area of Toronto. Where did that idea come from in terms of connecting it to the real places you were writing about?
One of the members of Diaspora Dialogues approached me because I think it's something that they do with a number of their authors when it applies, especially when it's in the city of Toronto.
Right.
It takes place there. My walking tour I ended up canceling it just because it started to get close. I know. And there were people planning to come, but it's interesting. The registration kind of included something that they didn't need. Like, if it would include a book, and then they were like, they already had the book, so they were just going to show up. So it didn't look like it had enough registrants. Plus, it was getting to that time of the year when it gets pretty brisk. So let me maybe try it for the spring. But I got all the information, went down, studied, took pictures, did all of the groundwork for it. But it is something that I've seen with Toronto authors here. And people are very interested in connecting the story to the landmarks. I haven't actually been on a walking tour, which is why I had to go down and do all of that research, because Toronto is an evolving city. It is crazy how fast the facade changes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm hoping to be able to revisit that in the spring.
Yeah, I moved out of Toronto about 4 years ago now. And anytime I go downtown, I feel like I've just come to the big city for the first time. Like, look at all these big buildings. Like, where did that come from?
It's Crane City. And like yourself, I moved out of the GTA. Well, I guess, are we still in the GTA in the Niagara region? Not really.
Depends. Yeah. Some people do that in their author bio. They're like, Toronto area. And you're like, you're in Burlington.
Yeah, we're not in the Toronto area. So I'm back and forth now, but I had moved from Stouffville out to the Niagara region. So you can imagine, even being in Stouffville, I would not have been in Toronto very often.
Right.
So it is night and day. Like, I'm constantly relearning the city. And our history is so fascinating. So I implore anyone to deep dive. I went to Riverdale Library and by the old Don Jail. And one interesting point that I'll raise about that area is that gentrification happened twice. In fact, the Donmount Court area where And the Walls Came Down takes place was a solution for gentrification and the removal of poorhouses from that neighborhood. And so how ironic is it that, 50 years later, the same premise ends up having that area completely resurfaced.
It was a well-meaning idea and a design that was supposed to bring all these families together and make a community and build a neighborhood, a close-knit neighborhood. And it did in some ways, but it also created these other pressures and other unforeseen problems. When your first book first comes out, the first few weeks, it's the thing I did. This is the thing I did. And then at a certain point, a weird thing happens that it becomes, this is a thing I did. Among the many great and brilliant things I've accomplished, I also accomplished this. But for a while, it's you. You're living in that book. It's the thing you're most proud of. Where does it sit now in terms of your feelings about it?
You caught me at an interesting time because I'm now looking at other genres, learning how to write screenplays and make graphic novels and I always will always have that as my base. And so the story for me is I'm trying to figure out the way to explain it. There will never be another story like that one for me. Never, if that makes sense. So even
You were
though it's
so close to it.
fiction,
You were so close to it.
just too close to it, but seeing it as a product of my creativity. Certainly, I'm at a point where I've been able to isolate the pieces of it that, yes, I would approach this piece a little different, or as I learn and hopefully one day master this craft that I love so much, I will always reflect on it. But I do have a bit of a hands-off approach with the book. Like I feel like you put it in the world, and I don't know where it will lead or where it'll go. I'm trying not to force it in any direction. But I will say that now that I'm starting to create new work, I wonder, how did I ever do that? Like, how did I get through that knowing absolutely nothing at all? Like, maybe it was better when I knew nothing, right? Because now I have to come up with something else. And that it is a challenge. Like it's definitely something that I have to, it is something else to overcome.
There's almost a confidence that comes out of ignorance or naivety where you're
Yes.
like, of
Oh
course it can be
man.
done. Other people have done it. I'll just do it. And then you're like, how did I find that? What was I accessing? What part of me?
Okay, I have a question for you. Have you ever gone back to something you've written and not recognized it at all?
In fact, this sounds like a humble brag, but I was looking for an essay I had written many, many years ago. I wanted to share it with a writing class that I'm teaching right now. And it was an essay that happened to have been picked for one of the best Canadian essays anthologies, the one and only time I ever got in it. I was looking for a good online version that I could share with the students, and I found an okay link. And then I opened up the anthology and realized it wasn't even the essay I was thinking of. It was a
No
completely
way.
different essay that was included in that anthology. I was like, I don't even remember writing this one. It was a
Wild,
complete.
right?
And I had read from it all these years. I had been thinking there was a different essay in that anthology. I'd never opened it up to look. I've put that in my bio. Like that's one of my like I'm a real writer. data points, and I just never looked. It was so strange. I've also had the experience of like skimming, looking through a book that I've written and coming across a line or a scene. I'm like, ooh, that's good. You know, where did that come from? I didn't come up with that, did I? Do you have that same thing with And the Walls Came Down? Have you ever looked through it and be like, I remember this part and I remember this part. This part in the middle is a bit of a mystery.
Not a mystery. I sat with that book too long.
It's all still in you?
It's all okay. Still in me. However, I know the newer parts. So the parts that I wrote 20 years ago, I recognize. And the newer parts that I put still surprise me. Like, oh yeah, I did come up with that new character at the end. And
right.
What a nice touch. And I wonder what would have happened if I'd left her out or, you know, that sort of thing. But I find it, because I don't have a lot of published work, I find it in my scrap stuff or my essays that I'll go back and read. And the reason I had to ask that is because I've never asked another writer that before, and I've never heard anyone talk about it. But I think those are the pieces that encourage me that somewhere inside me, I know how to write something. I'm just going to go back and hope that this can happen again. Like, can lightning strike a couple times? I think it's really interesting that we can separate that. I don't know what that is. I'm not quite sure how to articulate it.
It's almost like extreme compartmentalization, that just constantly filing things and
just completely learning how to forget.
I did also have the experience of, with my very first book, I asked a friend of mine to design the cover. ECW allowed me to do that. They just said, yeah, sure. It's a designer friend. And one thing I wanted was, it's a photo that he chose. I wanted one of the houses to be pink, because in the story, the family that it talks about is living in this pink house. And so the house is pink. He colored it. There's one house in the background that's pink. On the spine, he used like an outline of the pink house. So it's right there on the spine.
Right.
And then the book came out and someone at one point said, what's the significance of the pink house? And I was like, well, because the main character lives in a pink house. And they're like, they do? And then I was like, oh no, because I took that out 3 drafts ago. You're absolutely right. That's no longer part of the book. I don't trust myself when people ask me questions about books. Sometimes I'm like, I think the character does this, but that might be draft 8 and not the final book.
That's a fair result. I don't know how people keep it all in line.
It's a bit like, I mean, I still am, but I used to be, when I was a teenager, I was a massive, massive Beatles fan, like obsessed with the Beatles.
Right.
To where like, you could ask me any question, like who played tambourine on that song or who played the bass? Because it wasn't Paul McCartney. Like I would know all these stupid little trivia things. And then I would read interviews with like John Lennon and they would ask him about Beatles songs. And he'd be like, yeah, I don't really remember much about that. I don't know. Maybe it was Paul's song, maybe a bit of me. And I'd be like, you don't remember? How do you not remember? And now I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes total sense.
This is what happens.
You got to move on and do other stuff.
But you've done a lot. So I feel like it's something to aspire to, that when I've actually published another work, or when I'm, you know, when I've really moved on, maybe those attachments I have, those threads will thin and maybe I won't remember as much.
Well, and thank you for not calling me out for comparing myself to John Lennon. You know, like my work is about, it's sort of the Beatles, my work, it's roughly equivalent.
I think it's the same.
What Happened Next is produced and edited by me. The music playing under my voice is by the great Alex Lukaszewski, who is letting me use it for free. You can find more of Alex's music at alukaszewski.bandcamp.com. Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. There will be a new episode every Monday. Please buy more books, and not just new ones.